Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show is episode number 37, featuring my captivating conversation with Aisha Sasse, an award-winning journalist and author of the brand new book, Beneath the Tamarind Tree. In this heartrending discussion about sisterhood and survival, Aisha recounts the Boko Haram kidnapping of Nigerian schoolgirls in April 2014. Together, we explore faith, forgiveness, and how to help girls and women everywhere understand their power. On April 14, 2014, the terrorist group Boko Haram kidnapped 276 girls from a boarding school in Chibok, a small village in northeast Nigeria. The declared motive for the abduction of these girls was their disdain for education, specifically for young women. This tragedy stirred citizens all over the world and sparked one of the largest global social media campaigns with the hashtag #BringBackOurGirls. Many of you may recall seeing the headlines as the story unfolded in real time. Our esteemed guest today was at the very forefront of the reporting, on the ground in Nigeria, right after it happened. And she's remained a champion of the story and of those beautiful and brilliant girls in the years since. As a former correspondent for BBC News, Sky News, and CNN, Aisha Sasse has covered major breaking news stories and global events for nearly two decades. Her new book, Beneath the Tamarind Tree, provides that stirring account of the Chibok schoolgirls' kidnapping, along with elements of personal memoir from her own life. The book has just been released, and it's so phenomenal that I encourage all of you to pick it up and read it this summer. Not only does it contain rich and courageous reporting, with insight into African gender politics and women in the media, but it also provides an urgent and rousing call to action for the defense of women's rights around the world. Since their capture in 2014, around 100 of the schoolgirls have either escaped or been freed by Boko Haram. But unfortunately, over 100 more girls still remain missing to this very day. While the pace of the modern news cycle may have long since shifted its attention to other headlines, Aisha digs deeper, giving dignity to the survivors and reminding us that we must do more to find the remaining girls. No matter your occupation, your interest, or your goals, I know Aisha's insights will help you become better, more concerned global citizens who are willing, as Aisha says, to be upstanders and not merely bystanders. Without further ado, here's my conversation with the fiercely brave and inspiring Aisha Sasse. I'm sitting with someone who is a Peabody Award-winning journalist who has been on BBC, on Sky News, and on CNN for 13 years. You were always this beacon of light, telling stories of the world. And we are here to talk about your first book, soon to be a New York Times best-selling book. We're putting it out in the universe.
God willing.
About something that captivated the world's attention in 2014. When Boko Haram kidnapped over 200 girls in Nigeria. The brilliant book is called Beneath the Tamarind Tree, and it is a love letter to survival and resilience and this idea of bring back our girls. I want to start with an ode to your mother, a fellow English teacher, professor.
Yes.
And storyteller for years. I understand your mother was a professor at the university in your country, Sierra Leone. So tell us about what it's like to have a mother who made you dot I's, cross T's, and speak and write so beautifully.
So lovely to be here with you, and I'm just thrilled. So thank you. Let's start there. Having a mother who spent hours in the classroom every day was always a little challenging as a child because she brought some of that back home. So simple things like, what does this word mean? Wouldn't elicit a simple answer. It would get a, well, why don't you grab a footstool, climb up and get the dictionary and find out yourself? And you're thinking, cut me a break and just tell me. She sowed a seed in me for a constant quest for information and knowledge and an appreciation of books and arts and culture. And yeah, I remember as a child in England while I was growing up, they'd have these encyclopedia salesmen that would go door to door selling books. We didn't have a lot of money, and she actually got a stack of these encyclopedias for me that we paid monthly for. I mean, for her, nothing was too much when it came to me learning or my brother. She was just constantly on a quest to expand our minds. And so it was just a gift. It's an enormous gift to grow up with a teacher as a parent, and it shapes you in profound ways.
What I read at one point was your love affair with libraries, and that when you were at Trinity College at Cambridge, that you would just go in the library and spend hours upon hours feeling safe.
Yes.
And secure.
Yes.
So can you talk about the power of books for you and how those libraries and the lust for learning is what set you on this journey of being a journalist and now an author?
Libraries are incredible cocoons in which your mind can safely travel to all dimensions. And I just enjoyed browsing the aisles and looking at all these titles, being surrounded by so much knowledge and dipping in and trying different things. Books are a portal. Books are a portal to another dimension. Books are transformative. Books can help shift perspective and change your view of the world, yourself, and your place in it. They're magical. And so by extension, a space that holds books is magical. I think you just get a different quality of thought in a library.
You are on the eve of publishing your first book. As a journalist, you were exposed to Boko Haram and you needed to know more. So I love that you did that deep dive and said, it's not just enough for me to report on the nightly news. I need to study, I need to go, and I need to learn. So what was that decision like to say, I'm gonna leave from being in front of the camera, pick up a pen and start studying and writing and telling a story as an author?
I think when you do what I've done for almost two decades now with various organizations all put together, you realize how short-lived stories are, if you will, and how the format doesn't allow for it, especially these days where the cycle is moving so quickly. And I think my leftover feeling from having covered the story of the girls in 2014 was just that there were so many holes in the narrative. There was so much people didn't know and didn't understand. And it was very important to me to help correct the narrative and help broaden the understanding of what happened to the girls, not just that night, but before that night. I think that also when it comes to Africa specifically and the coverage of Africa, Africa is not always served well. And people don't always take the time to separate out the distinctive qualities of the characters and the places. And I just really felt that a book was the right format to do that, to explore it and to help people really grasp the magnitude of what happened. And so that's why I did it.
For a lot of our listeners, they might be students in a history class or an English class. Take us backwards to 2014, before it was a hashtag, before you were reporting on this story. Take us back to Nigeria and what happened with these beautiful, precious girls who, like you, love school and books and academia, and that was stolen from them.
I think the first frame to draw around this picture is the fact that these girls were taken from northeastern Nigeria, part of the country that has one of the highest out-of-school populations in the world. These girls were in their final year of high school. The average age was 17, 18, 19. So first of all, that is remarkable that their parents had allowed them to continue that far with their studies, because generally speaking, they would have been married off. That's the norm. But for these girls, they were, as a group, taking their end of high school exams. So there was a great amount of excitement because this was a threshold they were about to cross. They were about to really start the next chapter of learning, you know, and these girls, you know, the fact that they were there, as I said, was remarkable. These were girls whose parents had decided that they were their investment. Parents in this part of the world don't have stocks, they don't have bonds. What they have, their children, and they invest in their kids with expectation that their kids will mature, they will do better than they have done, and they will come back and look after them. So these girls are all acutely aware of their responsibilities and what success means. Very different to what success means to young people in the West, generally. There's more of a collective sense of the benefits of success in a place like northeastern Nigeria. So for them, you know, 2014, April 14th, which was the night this all happened, was a joyful, normal day. Some had exams, some didn't have exams. Some were outside playing late into the night. There were groups of girls watching. Some were in dorm rooms chatting and eating. And generally speaking, knew nothing was about to happen. And it was just after midnight when they heard the gunshots in the nearby town. What was interesting is these girls are from a place called Chibok. This is where it happened, which is a Christian enclave in the Muslim north of Nigeria. And faith plays a tremendously large part of their lives. There was a decision made amongst all of the girls, really. I think I can generally make that statement. All the girls that were in the school, whether they should run or they should stay, because they could hear something was happening. But the general consensus amongst most of them was, we should stay and pray. They are looking for supervision because there were teachers, some teachers around. Remember, they were out of school. They were just there to take these exams. So it wasn't a fully staffed school. But they're waiting for somebody to tell them what to do.
Someone with authority. Someone with authority.
And there had been situations in the school ahead of that night where there had been intruders, or there'd been the suggestion or thought that someone had come into the school. And the school officials had told them, if something happens, do not leave. If anything happens, stay in your dorms and wait for a teacher to come.
For me as an educator, I think that's the hardest lesson I've learned when there's atrocities or genocides. It's when people seek a school or a
place where they should be safe.
And they feel that they should be safe. And those places of safety are anything but.
Yeah.
So the girls are waiting.
They're waiting and nobody comes. I describe this in the book. There is a conversation amongst a group of girls where some have their belongings bundled up and want to run. And there's this conversation, should we run? Well, what if we run and this is just a false alarm and we get into trouble with authorities? Some are saying, what if we run and we get injured? Why don't we just stay and pray? And so they're there waiting when the first Boko Haram militant drives into the school on a motorbike, doesn't say anything, just kind of drives in through the gate, because all the girls were in the hostel, kind of takes it all in and drives out. Doesn't say anything. Now for the girls, they're thinking, what is happening? Who is this individual? But when they eventually come back a few moments later as a larger group, they tell them that they're Nigerian soldiers. The girls I interviewed for the book all say that it didn't sit right. They said they were soldiers. They were wearing fatigues and camouflage, but then they looked closely and saw that some were wearing flip-flops. Some didn't have shoes on their feet. Some had water bottles tied with string. One girl describes them as looking more like herders, cattle herders, than soldiers. But the men said, we are Nigerian soldiers and we're here to protect you. Don't be afraid. Just gather around and be quiet. Again, remember, this happened in Chibok in Borno State, the birthplace of Boko Haram, an area that was under a state of emergency at that point in time. So there were soldiers in and around the town. There were about 24 soldiers. So it wasn't beyond the realm of possibility. Plus, remember, they were so desperate for an authority figure to turn up that they almost willed it. They wanted them to be their source of safety and protection. It was only when one of them suddenly said, we are Boko Haram, we know what is happening here, you're in school and we've said you should not be in school, that the game was up. And at that point, they'd already corralled them into this group and suddenly they were just pouring in. And that's the one thing that gets me every time when I think about that moment. As a child, it's after midnight, it's dark, there's pandemonium, you can smell burning, and hordes of armed men are streaming into your school. My heart, each and every time, I'm just overwhelmed at the terror that those girls felt. The girls who I profile in the book, you know, they all say that they thought that it was going to follow the same playbook that they were aware of, which was Boko Haram was going around attacking schools in northern Nigeria. Boko Haram, which loosely translates to education is a sin. They knew that they wanted girls to not be educated and instead leave and be married. And they had been attacking schools and harming boys. So as far as the girls knew or thought or expected, they were going to be let go. The men came, and once it became clear they were Boko Haram, the men started to question them. They asked them, where are the boys? The girls explained, the boys are day students. They're not here. They leave after class. They said, where's the brick-making machine? They said, where's the fuel? The girls are like, we don't really know what you're talking about. They said, well, take us to your store where they keep your foodstuffs. And pointed a gun at a girl who was accompanied by another friend. In fact, they pointed a gun at a girl and said, show us. And she was frozen and couldn't move, just terrified. And a friend of hers, you know, these moments of bravery, a girl stepped forward and said, come. And the two of them went with this fighter. But the girls thought they'd empty the store and then they would leave. So in their minds, and I've asked them this question over and over again, what were you thinking? They just thought they'll tell us to go. So it was with great shock that the men emptied the store, then started burning the school, followed by, let's move. But even then they were like, go where? They make them walk for about 15 minutes to an area outside of town. They find vehicles parked in a clearing. They say, sit down under the tree, say your last prayers. Again, the girls are like, are we about to be killed? And then they say, start getting in the truck. And if you don't want to get in the truck, let us know and we'll kill you now. It was at that moment, it was only at that moment that they thought, we're not being killed, we're being kidnapped. We're not being set free. They're taking us away. But they had no idea. They had absolutely no idea until that moment where they said, get in the truck. They were just convinced this was a story that would have a different ending.
At that moment, these girls are in the trucks. Did any of them escape?
Yes. So Boko Haram swept out of the school with 276 girls that
276.
Night. 276. In the hours afterwards, as they traveled into Sambisa Forest, which is their home, the home of the militant group, 57 escaped. They jumped off trucks. They slid away when they stopped to cook, as they did at a certain point. They got some of those food items and they said to the girls, cook. And they lit a fire and they chose a couple of the girls who cooked a meal. It was at that point that one of the girls in my story escaped. And before that moment, a different girl in my book, she had jumped off a truck before they'd even stopped. So 57 escaped at different points along the way, but all of them escaped before they got to the camp.
So for you as a journalist, you're an international correspondent for CNN at that time, the story breaks. What was that like for you, having been educated in London at Cambridge, but your roots are Sierra Leone? Suddenly, this is personal. For you reporting the story, what was stirring inside of you each and every time you got to tell the story to the world?
So I was in Atlanta when the story broke, and I'd come off air and was told that girls had been taken from a school. But it didn't really make any sense. And that's the thing about this story. Nothing made sense at the beginning. First of all, again, we were battling with the notion that it was a school and where were the teachers? You know, did they put up a fight? There were just so many unanswered questions. The Nigerian government was saying very little. They couldn't get the numbers right. And they claimed that all but eight of them had been found. And the parents weren't available to speak. There were just so many gaps. But the one thing that grabbed me was the fact that I knew about northeastern Nigeria. So I knew that the fact that these girls were in school made them heroes already. The fact that they were there made them extraordinary, because the norm would be that they would have been married off with kids by now. So that struck me immediately as, wow, this is a travesty, but also understanding how poor that part of the world is and how Nigeria is such a class-conscious society. And because it's the Muslim North and the president at the time was Southern Christian, I was aware of all these divisions, these tension points in the story, which made me really look at it to see how it was going to play out. But it didn't go viral immediately. I mean, it broke April 14th, and we had a correspondent on the ground, a very dear friend of mine, Vladimir Doutier, who now works for CBS, but he was our CNN correspondent at the time. And he worked hard to get information, and he just couldn't really get much. But for me, I knew the environment, and I also, for me as an African, I felt this story needs someone to champion it. This story and these girls, because I already had a nonprofit at that point working with adolescent girls in Sierra Leone. So it just kind of hit all these passion points for me. And then there was also this other more deeply rooted connection to the story, which was my mother comes from a place not dissimilar to Chibok. Once I got to know more about the area, my mother comes from a home where her father, my grandfather, had multiple wives. My grandmother sold fresh goods and canned goods in the market, in the local market. Neither of my grandparents were educated. My mother collected water from a nearby river, and they didn't have electricity, and they didn't have much money. And I understand, and I understand it to my core, and I say it close to every day of my life, that if my mother had not been educated, I wouldn't be where I am in my life. If my mother had not been educated, I would have been born in a place like Chibok.
What I love about your mother, the ode you pay to her, is as a scholar, someone with a PhD, someone who's political. I also read that she was one of the first and only women to run for the vice president of her country. And if you think about the trajectory, it changed in one generation.
That's right.
From your grandparents to your mother to you.
Yeah.
So this is personal.
It's personal.
You're on the air at night, and suddenly the idea, I need more. I need to go there. And I know that you were asked to escort these young women out of captivity when 20 of them were going to be released.
You know, this is one of these moments where you don't know until you get up close to the story. So the story broke. We didn't have much information. I was deployed to Nigeria about 2 weeks later, in all honesty, not to cover this story, because nobody understood that the Nigerian government had effectively imposed an information blackout. Nobody knew that the Nigerian government wasn't actually doing anything to find them, anything meaningful to find them. Nobody knew. Nobody was reporting that. Nobody got the sense of that sitting in Atlanta or in newsrooms around the world. I got to Nigeria 2 weeks later. I landed and tweeted that I'm in Nigeria and was bombarded by social media and people saying, "Are you here to cover the girls? Are you here to find out what really happened?" And I remember thinking, what do you mean? Everybody knows what happened. That's when I realized, we don't know. There's something else at play here. Like my reporter's gut said, nothing is being said. There's a blackout. As I asked more questions, I realized that I was there to cover the wrong story. And then I reached out to my CNN bosses in Atlanta and I said, we shouldn't be here covering the World Economic Forum, a gathering of world leaders and celebrities. We should be digging into this story. It's not adding up. Something's wrong here. And full credit to CNN, they recalibrated the reporting plans. And that's when we changed and focused on this story. And we started to dig. We started to really push and then realize no army had gone to the town to help find the girls, that they hadn't really spoken to the parents. We found that out almost 2.5-3 weeks later. That's when the story went viral. That's when, with us on the ground pushing it, suddenly we were surrounded by more international media. I will honestly say, and it's the truth, CNN led the way on that story and shone such a bright light, not in terms of the hashtag, but in terms of global media suddenly picking up on it. It was the perfect storm. And then it went viral and it was everywhere. But it didn't start off like that. It didn't start off like that. We just didn't know. And sometimes you have to go. You have to get up close and speak to the people yourself. You cannot report from a distance and think that you're getting the full story. And that's what I learned with this story.
So when did reporting for CNN become a passion project to pin a book that would allow us to peel back those layers, to know these girls, to know their story?
I just could never understand how the story was everywhere then nowhere. In the space of 2 weeks, it was over. I couldn't understand how more than 200 girls could go missing and there'd be no credible information about their whereabouts for over 2 years. It just didn't make any sense that they could lose these girls. And that just stayed with me 1 year, 2 years. And then I just thought, no, someone needs to dig into this. You can't just lose children. And because I kept up my relationship with the community, I understood that parents were dying from grief. I understood that the Nigerian government was giving them next to no information, and largely because they are poor and from the north, had kind of a minimal commitment to them. And all of these things, the sense of injustice just burned in me. When I sold the book, to be honest, I sold it as a completely different book to the book that people will read. Because when I sold the book in September 2016, only one girl had escaped. And her name is Amina Ali Nkeki, and she escaped in May. So I was going to write a cold case book and say, how haven't they found them? I was just tying up the book deal when 21 were released, which changed the book entirely and changed my focus slightly, because then I wanted to know what had happened while they were in captivity, and then decided to write a book that had a little more narrative than analysis.
So for you to escort these beautiful
which
women,
happened in October, which also I should say to you, even that is complicated, because when the girls were released in October 2016, I got on the plane that night and went to Nigeria. I met them for the very first time during that trip. They went home for the very first time in December of 2016. The reason I was in Nigeria in December 2016 was not to report on them. I happened to be there because my mother had had a catastrophic stroke and was hospitalized in Nigeria. And that's when I got the tip that the girls were going home. So my mother was in a coma, and I had to decide whether or not to go home with them, whether I'd carry on the story and take them home. And I had to think back to whether my mother would want me to do that. And the scholar in her and the champion of women and girls that she is told me that she would say, go home with them.
Go home with her. Bring back our girls.
Bring back our girls.
What was that like to see a homecoming of mothers and fathers? And I get emotional just picturing it in my mind, but you lived it live in person. So paint a picture of what that was like to reunite.
When we got there, their parents were already lined up outside, and it was hot, and life is hard in those parts of the world. You know, you can see it in their physical form, but they were patient and they were earnest. And we went straight into this compound that was walled, and the girls waited patiently. And it wasn't straightforward, because we got there and the girls had been told that they were going to leave with their parents and go home. But in actual fact, when they got there, they were suddenly told that it was too dangerous for them to go home, so their parents would have to come and stay with them in the house. Be that as it may, when their parents finally did, it erupted. I mean, the sound, you can't actually do them justice, because as much as they're joyful, they're pained as well. They're loaded. And the point to make is that these girls had been reunited with their parents in October when they were released. But now in Chibok, more family was seeing them for the very first time. And so it was exultant. It was triumphant. It was agonizing. It was tearful, it was painful, and in amidst this beautiful, painful joy, there was something else which I didn't pick up on immediately. There was deep, distressed crying, and at first I didn't know what it was, because there were so many reunions happening simultaneously, and it didn't sound right, the tone didn't sound right. And I walked into the other room and I found these mothers flat out on the ground screaming. And what had happened was that when they told the townspeople that the girls were coming back, they didn't tell them that only 21 were coming back.
Oh.
So these parents thought their daughters had been freed. So they had turned up looking for their children who weren't there. I tried to help some of them get up, and they were just crestfallen. They were just crestfallen. So in amongst that joy was this indescribable pain.
of mothers confronted with reunions that they weren't a part of. And that will stay with me forever.
I realize that they've released 107 since you started the book project. Were you there for any other homecomings?
No. So I got back to LA after my mother's illness. I got back in February of 2017, and then another 82 were released in May, and a few other girls have escaped in between, which brings them up to 107. I wasn't there for their homecoming, but I have seen all of them because I traveled to Abuja and I saw some of them in the safe space that were keeping them in. And the one thing that struck me, obviously the 21 I met in October when they first came out, I traveled with them to Chibok, so I have a relationship with them. The 82 I hadn't met, so imagine my surprise when I go to where they were being housed at the time and I'm surrounded by children. And the thing is, you would think that after what they'd been through, there would be something of a disconnect, especially with strangers, a reticence, a wariness. But that wasn't my experience. It was just joy.
And I love that your story talks about their resilience and their courage, that these young women now want to be doctors and lawyers and
politicians. And Priscilla, who's in my book, and she was held for 2.5 years. I spent time with her in Abuja last year, and she wanted to be a doctor before this happened. And I asked her whether she still wanted to be a doctor. And she said, you know, I don't know anymore if that's what I want, but I do know I want to be somebody. I do know that. And I was struck by her response to the question of whether they'd forgiven their captors. I was interviewing her with her best friend, Bernice. They automatically, without pause, without a beat, said, of course we've forgiven them. We forgave them the very first day. I didn't, you know, I kind of questioned it. I mean, how is that possible? And so, well, they clearly, you know, are mistaken because they think they're doing God's work and God wouldn't want this. So they don't really know what they're doing. So we pray for them.
So it's a book about reconciliation.
It's a book about reconciliation.
And forgiveness.
And forgiveness and faith and sisterhood and overcoming. And I've seen them together. I've spoken to their teachers. I've spoken to people who care for them and asked them whether they fight, whether they bicker. They don't. They didn't do it when they were in captivity either. The sisterhood was strong with them. They didn't break down into cliques and no, they were there for each other.
I want to read for our audience a beautiful line in praise of your book by Hillary Clinton. She said, it is no accident that the places in the world where we see the most instability are those in which the rights of women and girls are denied. So for the girls throughout the world who listen to this podcast, what is your call to action for them?
It is to fully understand the power of education and how it can transform their current situation to something indescribable. I tell my mother's story in the book. There's a memoir element in it because I believe that I can give you all the data points in the world about education and what it means and what it can do, but it won't resonate in the way of hearing somebody else's story. So I think my call to action for girls is for them to understand that if they are lucky enough to be in school, that they are able to unlock new chapters in their lives, in their future, that I'd like to see them support and mentor peer-to-peer other girls and help them along. I would like to see them understand their own power, right? I want girls to feel powerful, even in these spaces where everyone's fighting to take that power from them, for them to understand that they are valuable, they are strong, they are worthy, and that they are capable, even if they're surrounded by environments that tell them that they don't possess these qualities, that they do have them, and to hold that education to restructure, recalibrate their own lives. I truly want them to believe in themselves.
And you lead by example. You've started this incredible nonprofit, an NGO. We, women everywhere, can lead.
Yeah.
and you concentrate on these beautiful women of Africa.
Yes. Our Girls Empowerment Workshop is all about that. It is all about them understanding their strengths, their weaknesses, what makes them unique, helping them understand their sense of self and allowing them to journal and be in these workshops in terms of critical thinking. We work with helping building their confidence and self-esteem. All of that, I think it's key to helping them. If they have that foundation and know who they are, then they can go forward. You can't if you don't know who you are. You don't know where you're going. If you have to know where you start and who you are. So my girls now say things to me like, Auntie Aisha, we're going to do more than you ever did. And they believe, you know, this is the whole point, right? Like, if they believe, they can actually strive for it. And now they do. Now they truly do. You know, after just 1 year in my program, now they believe. They believe that everything is open to them. Now we have to help them with the opportunity, right? They can have the belief, but they're still working in environments or living in environments that aren't necessarily hospitable to girls and their potential. So we have to work with them to help carve the path. But they need to start by believing.
Everything that you touch, everything that you do, everything that you speak is about interconnectedness.
Yes.
For our audience, male and female, can you tell our audience the importance of being an upstander, not a bystander? That interconnectedness that you so brilliantly write about.
I've been talking a lot about being an upstander, not a bystander recently, and I was speaking a couple of weeks ago in Sweden about empathy and how we need more of it. And we need it not just for people who are similar to ourselves, but people who don't look like us, who don't even share the same cultures as us. I think that we are at a time when our political leaders are failing us, and we're at a time where international bodies, organs for collective action and accountability are not functioning. International Criminal Court, the UN Security Council. This is a moment where the global citizenry must stand up. This is a moment where we have to look beyond our borders and look at the number of crises that are taking place around the world. There are approximately 70 million people that have been displaced around the world from conflict right now, the largest number since World War II. The world is rife with instability and these populations are desperate. It is not enough to simply sit on the sidelines and say, I'm not getting involved. Just because you don't say anything and don't get involved doesn't mean you haven't chosen a side. You have chosen a side. So my question is, will people stand up? Will they use their platforms? Will they tweet? Will they write articles? Will they write to their legislators? Will they share books that deepen information? Will they support nonprofits? Will they do what they can? Will they sit down or will they stand up? What will you do at this moment in time? My call to everyone, to global citizenry, is this is a time to be an upstander. The world now more than ever needs the power of grassroots citizenry to make this world a better place.
One of the things I love about this book is how you are paying it forward. So tell our audience who are gonna rush to the bookstores today or get it online, tell them how you are doing something unique and special with the proceeds of this book.
Yes, it's important to me that we help these girls on their journey to healing and wholeness. So I'm giving a portion of the proceeds from my book to a fund, which I'm naming after my mother, the Kadisase Wellness Fund, to help them with what I call the visible and invisible wounds, because the trauma is very much a part of their lives. And some of them have serious medical ailments that they developed while in captivity. So I'm building this fund, which is also open to public donation. That money is going to benefit the girls in their school in Northern Nigeria. And we just want to help them on this journey. And so I'm starting this with a view that other people will not just come along and donate, but we'll also start the conversation once more about them. It's important we remember 112 girls still haven't been accounted for, still have not come back. We need to start this conversation again on a global level and put pressure on the Nigerian government to tell us what they are doing to find these girls. They won't do that willingly unless the whole world once again unites, again, global citizenry standing up, using our voice and demand once more, bring back our girls. Yeah.
so grateful to our guest, Aisha Sissé, for her deep passion and unshakable commitment to empowering girls across the world. My dear listeners, may we help girls everywhere understand their power, understand their purpose. And in response to Aisha's clarion call to action, may we all make the choice to be upstanders and not merely bystanders. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. I've already bought Aisha's new book as a gift for several freedom riders and their darling daughters. And I encourage you to do the same by simply following the link in our show notes. We also hope you consider sharing the podcast with a friend or a family member or anyone you think who could benefit from these extraordinary guests like Aisha. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Serrier and Rob Falk, with a special thanks to Harry Calbum, Matt Sanders, and the entire talented team at Society in Los Angeles. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.